So, in case you aren't aware who I am, my name's John Sinmez. I'm a PhD student here, and the reason I've been asked to do this particular workshop is because my thesis topic is structured sickness, AIDS, cancer, and poetic form. And obviously that's going to affect the selection of poems I've made, and indeed all four of these are ones that I discuss in my thesis. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't restrict us to just talking about form or the kind of issues I'm interested in. So I'm hoping that we're going to generate discussion rather than just me talking at you, but we'll see how it goes.
But so we can help you with your research as well.
Indeed,
yeah,
yeah, that is in the back of my mind too, so that's useful. So I thought first we'd just, if you'd like, say your name and why you wanted to come to the seminar.
Okay, I'm Fran. I was never interested in kind of sexual health at all, but now I've been kind of forced to like read up about it, find out about it. The statistics, the kind of, you know, the medical side of it as well, and I think kind of combining it with poetry could be such an interesting, fascinating thing. And when I thought about it, I couldn't think of any poets that I knew of that have written about AIDS. You know, why aren't people writing about it? You know, not only like, you know, odes to condoms or, you know, kind of more modern stuff, but, you know, monologues or personal accounts of dealing with AIDS, of kind of HIV in Africa, you know, like all these kind of things that people should be talking about and expressing through art and through poetry. And that's why I'm here, to find out more about that and if there are poets who do talk about it.
Cool. Okay. So I'm Claudia, and I'm I know quite a lot about literature and disease. Yeah. I kind of worked on it a little bit. But what I actually never came across is really the poetry in disease. I've always kind of had, you know, the main literature on disease, which is normally not poetry, really.
Mm.
And so I'm interested to know about a little bit more about this form and what is the difference to kind of other kinds of prose. That what I'm really interested in to learn.
I'm Izzy, and I'm an English and American Lit student. So, and I like writing poetry, so I wanted to kind of come along and, you know, I try and do workshops when I can. But yeah, I think also AIDS is something that is always discussed in newspapers and on television and stuff, but like it's not really put into art because it's such a controversial subject. So like a lot of people, I mean, I'm sure there must be like quite a lot of poetry out there, but it would be such a subgenre that like it's not really very well known. So yeah, I want to find out like more about the people who write it and things, and see what kind of a canon it's got.
Okay, cool.
Can I just ask you, Ken, like why are you writing about AIDS for your thesis? Like what kind of attracted you to it?
Well, the reason I started the PhD in the first place was from an interest in poetic form. So that's the angle I'm coming at it from. And it took me a while to find the right topic, which seems to be a common thing with PhDs. You kind of work through a bunch of failed material until you finally pare it down to a good topic. And I started off just grabbing at things, and somebody mentioned sincerity and authenticity. So that was the initial topic, and I encountered some of the person talking about, so Tom Gunn I discussed in that, and also Peter Redding, and that was from the angle of how can you be genuine and honest when writing in poetic form. But the problem with that topic is sincerity and authenticity are massive philosophical terms, and there's a reams of reading you have to do around that, so that was far too broad.
That.
And that was why I pushed that away. So I had to think about it, and I've had a couple of temporary withdrawals, the first one to rethink, and I decided that the strongest parts of my thesis were actually the ones where I was talking about how poets dealt with illness, terminal disease and death. So I decided to pare it down to focus on just those aspects of the PhD, which is how it's got into its current state.
Cool.
Okay, so I was planning that, well, I was working off the idea that we're starting at 3, so I don't, are we going to be able to run over, or was the deadline 4 o'clock?
Yeah, no, that's fine.
Because I was presuming dividing up the hour so we'd have about a couple of minutes at the start to chat, then a few minutes at the end, and spend about 10, 12 minutes on each poem. So that's why I'm going to be looking at my phone repeatedly rather than tripping on checking messages.
Beautiful timing.
Which is all good, yeah. I had it all carefully planned, it's not 3.
One.
Yeah, there's no writing in this part of the seminar, that comes later. Okay, so a lot of these poems all of these poems are from the US. So I'm looking very much at an American perspective on the epidemic. Mm-hmm. Although our first poet is English, Tom Gunn, and he studied at Cambridge. He moved to America in the 60s, specifically San Francisco, to be with his lover, Mike Attay. And he understands the difference that obviously resulted in, because in England he felt very repressed, very restricted, whereas in San Francisco, particularly because the building gay rights movement sort of kicked off there, really, and he certainly enjoyed the fruits of that liberated atmosphere, to say the least. So he's well known for being very promiscuous, did lots of drugs, all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he also started off writing in very strict form, if you look at his collections from, say, the 50s. Then kind of moved into free verse, so it got a lot looser with the influence of various poets in America and the whole ethos of the 60s and 70s. But when it came to AIDS, he decided to return to form for this particular section of his collection from 1992, The Man with Night Sweats. And that followed on from his last collection, which was The Passages of Joy in 1982. So you can see in that 10-year period is exactly when the epidemic was at its height. So he would see a lot of his friends dying from AIDS. He didn't actually have it himself. He didn't have HIV. And I think he died in dubious circumstances, but not because of that. So he's looking at it from the perspective of someone seeing his friends die rather than his own illness. So this is the titular poem. So would someone like to read it out? It's probably the easiest one to read out of the four we've got.
I'll do it then, if it's the easiest one.
Okay.
I wake up cold, I who prospered through dreams of heat baked to their residue, sweat, and a clinging sheet. My flesh was its own shield, where it was gashed, it healed. I grew as I explored the body I could trust, even while I adored the risk that made robust. A world of wonders in each challenge to the skin. I cannot but be sorry, the given shield was cracked, my mind reduced to hurry, my flesh reduced and wrecked. I have to change the beds, but catch myself instead. Stopped upright where I am, hugging my body to me, as if to shield it from the pains that will go through me, as if hands were enough to hold an avalanche off.
Thanks, Ryan. So I can babble about this for a bit, or is there anything any of you would like to say initially about thoughts on that?
Well, the whole like defence and attack idea that, you know, that it's obviously quite like battle language, you know, shield, and this whole idea of a crack kind of coming through it. So you did have defence. And isn't that just like HIV, where it's your immune system that's being attacked? So you are literally cracking to it, your defences are cracking.
Yeah, I'd say. I mean, I obviously have my own interpretations of all these poems. But.
So I'm like, oh, obviously I have the right answer.
I didn't say right. That's the great thing about English, you can't be right or wrong.
It's
just about
having
a good argument.
It's why
I do that. It's fabulous, okay.
I like it because I feel it kind of, because I wrote a piece a while ago on cancer in the body, and like my main kind of focus in it was like the body betraying itself, like the body is your defence mechanism against illnesses, and skin is, you know, the last barrier and things like that. But then here, like, it's broken down completely, like, so it's kind of a hopeless, helpless situation, because if your body can't defend itself, then like, what are you going to do? So that's what I took from it.
Any thoughts?
Yeah, I think I like this, you know, the line when you said the body I could trust, so this kind of idea that you never think about it, and at some point, you know, also in this gay culture that you celebrate it, and it's kind of beautiful, and it's very
important.
And you
important. Know it, you know it. You think you know your body, and then you find something inside it that you can't control.
Exactly. And then also, I like that particular thing. Yeah, I grew up with, I explored the body, I could trust, even my daughter was going like a bus. So this whole kind of sexual culture, which is so, which made him or this person, whatever, be his body, and that at some point now becomes the, not only the risk, but the death. I think I've given a way of expressing it, I think.
And I think, like, also this, you know, as Manu says, hugging my body to me, it's kind of like this shrivelled up case that he's kind of like, oh, no, where has it gotten, you know?
Or like a child.
Yeah.
Okay. And I don't suppose anyone noticed any details about the form he's using there.
Oh, I can do.
Shut up with your form.
Wait.
I've got lots to chat about it.
I'm an English student, but I should do this. Couplets, quatrains, rhyme schemes.
I don't know, like it's a whole sing-song thing, isn't it? And it's you
it's
know, like it does
more
feel
specific than
quite
that.
childlike in its way. You know, where you're like, oh, you know, I thought I could trust it, and then made robust, and you're kind of hopeful, and then like the couplet kind of brings it in, and you're like, no, I'm still gonna die. You know,
yeah.
That kind of sombrerity.
And there's a quite specific form he's using. So I don't know how metrically aware people are, but
I should be more aware.
Without getting well, I'm not great myself, but not to get too complex. It's mainly iambic trimeter, and that is 3 feet, as so a foot is generally 2 syllables. And yeah, so I am.
This is where you're like.
So it's unstressed stress.
Like Shakespeare.
So you can see that particularly
is
if you really like my yeah, I mean it's like my flesh was its own shield, where it
was
gashed it
healed,
etc, etc. The interesting thing about this in terms of form is that that shifts and it fits with the subject matter, because if you then look further down to I cannot but be sorry, that isn't iambic trimeter, it's I cannot but be sore, and then it has a hypermetrical syllable, so he's added on another syllable and breaks the pattern. So instead of ending conclusively, like my flesh with its own shields, it's sorry. It's unfinished, it's uncertain, there's a break there. So the technical term is hypermetrical syllable, but basically it just means an extra syllable on the end.
Hypermetrical.
Hypermetrical.
Oh,
there's also extra metrical, there's all kinds of things. There's a nice big Princeton Encyclopedia of Poetry and Poetics, if anyone wants to look into it. Which I'm sure you'll enjoy greatly. yeah, so that's one aspect of this breaking down. So it's reflecting the same way his body's breaking down, now his form is breaking down. On top of that, if you look at the rhymes there, you'll notice sorry, hurry, cracked, wrecked, as opposed to in, skin, robust, trust, exploded, adored.
Half rhyme.
Half rhyme, exactly. So it's not full rhyme anymore. There's something has changed, something's broken down, there's uncertainty. And that continues if you look to stopped upright where I am, it from, and then he has two more hypermetrical syllables on this one, hugging my body to me, the pains that will go through me, and then the final couplet again, that's not a full rhyme, enough and off, so there's an uncertainty there. So you can track this through the poem, seeing how from a creative point of view, if you're looking at writing about a particular subject, you can use form to aid you in getting your message across and also focusing the emotive power of the piece. So has anyone got any other points, or should I keep adding?
Well, I quite like, you know, when you first brought up the sorry bit, like why, and the fact that it is the word sorry, and that kind of like draws it out, and I don't know, it brings a lot of shame and guilt of someone who isn't suffering from it, and you can't do anything to help, and it's kind of like fading away, and I can just keep blabbering on, please someone chip in people, you know.
Come on, I'm happy to keep going. For example, the theme of this, which I think Claudia pointed out well, is that it starts off very secure. He's a liberated gay man in San Francisco, he's enjoying himself. There's no worries about disease, because as if you look at one of the sources I've got on my quotes, Randy Schiltz and the Glampodon, which I'm totally familiar with, talks about in the 70s it was very common to get a disease, go to the clinic, get back in bed with someone, go to the clinic, get back in bed, so people didn't really take it seriously. And to do the exact quote, ever since he had worked at the New York City Department of Health, Dr. Dan William had delivered his lecture about the dangers of undiagnosed venereal diseases and, in particular, such practices as rimming. But he had his regulars, who came in with infection after infection, waiting for the magic bullet that can put them back in the sack again. So that kind of attitude, you can see, is going to be very dangerous when you get a disease like AIDS, which changes things completely. You can't get an easy cure for AIDS. There isn't one.
The culture of bathhouses as well.
Yeah,
I mean,
absolutely.
Just made this whole thing just so, like, people would go out consciously knowing that they had a disease, but they just, if they just wanted to get off, they would just go to the bathhouse, because they always find somebody there. And even when there was, it was kind of advertised as gay, like the gay cancer kind of thing, like, you know, unless you had outward signs of disease, then nobody knew, so people would just ignore it, themselves, I think, as well. Like, they would just, you know, carry on with their lives and their sex lives as it was, like, nothing had happened, because that's the only way they could cope with it.
So if you're interested in that topic, then you should check Randy Schultz, because he has a long section on the bathhouse. It's in the further reading. And there's also a poet I was considering including, but I don't actually think he's that good, but he does comment on that specifically. He's Robert Boucheron. I can give you the details if you'd like. He was writing in 85, if I recall correctly, so right in the middle of it. And he was talking exactly about it, because he wrote a series of epitaphs, so doing it as a dramatic monologue. And he usually did them in pairs, so he'd have things like Epitaph for a Carrier, sort of talking about how he was going to bathhouse to get off because he was so stressed. And
what's his name again?
Robert Boucheron. So Boucheron.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
And the book's called Epitaphs for the Plague Dead. So it's quite hard to find, but I do have it in PDF form, if someone wants to read it. But
the Plague Dead.
Plague Dead, yeah. So he's got some specific poems in there, so it's interesting from this perspective, but to find out more about the social impact, then Randy Schultz is a good source.
Can I ask you something about the, because you said that you're working on your, this form aspect.
Mm.
So is then your, is then the claim that basically that kind of very specific, very deliberate form here, I mean, and kind of, you know, breaking it down to a kind of different rhythm and things like that, is then your, is your view that basically that actually, that form is a necessary means to actually bring out the meaning?
That's a big question, and it's been a big question in poetry for since it started. So it's
and you just touched on it.
No, I'm not saying touch it. It's but it's a good question in terms of my interest, because I'm quite clearly fond of form, and my preferred poems are in form.
Mm.
But that's where the interesting part comes in terms of talking about disease. Is it better to write in form? Without form,
mm-hmm.
does it make any difference? Does it depend on the person? Are there any advantages? And we're going to get onto that later in the third poem, which you'll see is very different from this one, completely different approach to structure. But the next one we're going to go on to now, Voices Gym Body by Tori Dent. It's in form again, but this one is quite different from Gunn's form, and also Tori Dent's background is very different. Because unlike Gunn, Tori Dent, firstly, she's a woman. Secondly, she's heterosexual. And thirdly, she had AIDS and died from it. So she was writing this while suffering in hospital.
Mm-hmm.
The way she contracted AIDS brings up another topic that surrounds the whole AIDS epidemic, which is that she got it from a haemophiliac boyfriend.
Mm-hmm.
And as you may be aware, haemophiliacs were very much affected by the AIDS crisis because they rely on blood transfusions, particularly something called factor VIII, which is made up of many thousands of blood plasma. And the blood supply in America got infected by HIV, which meant lots of haemophiliacs contracted AIDS just from their regular medical treatment.
Like, is that kid Ryan White?
Yeah, he was one example, so in 85, famous. So that brings up the whole question of supposedly innocent versus guilty victims, which is this whole blame culture which often surrounds AIDS, like, oh, you've been off having unprotected sex, you deserve to have AIDS, which is ridiculous, of course, but it's, and children and so on. So she would effectively count in the innocent camp in that particular dichotomy.
Mm-hmm.
So, would someone like to read this one?
You tell me how to pronounce the fifth word, but
I
think
know, I have very good
I can never do it.
I think it's rapprochement, but I wouldn't worry too much about it.
Okay. In order for a rapprochement with the physical body, only necromancy could be behind it. Racked on a stretcher, the IV tubes string me up like a cello without a player. Only necromancy could be behind it. These days of horse-drawn betrayal. Like a cello without a player, I'm caught, crown of thorns, in a winter orchard. These days of horse-drawn betrayal. Impromptu night, tar edge. I'm caught, a crown of thorns, in a winter orchard. A keyboard silent, as the keyboard's deaf Beethoven. Impromptu night, tar edge. I insert the child's hand literally into my chest. A keyboard silent as the keyboard's deaf Beethoven, as if a surgeon was like a walnut. I insert the child's hand literally into my chest. Fingers twitch like an impulse, final in a motive, as if a surgeon was like a walnut with my voice, overbuilt to compensate for no child. Fingers twitch like an impulse, final in a motive. The way one man survived was by altarpiece commissions, with my voice. Overbuilt to compensate for no child. Like an altarpiece, I try continually to build. The way one man survived was by altarpiece commissions, reactionary structure, the ivy tubes string me up like an altarpiece. I try continually to build in order for a rapprochement with the physical body.
Thanks. So, first reaction to that one?
I can't remember the technique that she uses.
You recognise what she's doing there?
Yes. It's almost it's a similar technique used in like a villanelle, but it's not. So, and I can't for the life of me remember.
The word you're looking for is pantoum.
Thank you.
It's P-A-N-T-O-U-M. It's a repeating structure. So you can see here, if you look at the first paragraph, that the second and fourth lines become the first and third lines of the next paragraph. And that continues until the end, where you'll see the lines from the first stanza reappear. So,
so
it's
it has to have seven stanzas?
No, I think it can have as many as you want. It's just that. That's just the closing stanza.
Yeah.
As far as we're aware, there may be some more complex mathematical structures involved. But so, this obviously operates very differently from a poem about rhyme, rhythm, and meter, because this is working through repetition. So that does a number of things. The first thing is that, from a creative point of view, it's a lot easier to write because you've only got to write less lines because you can keep repeating them. But from a, in terms of its impact, I don't know about you, but I find it's very good for things about memory, isolation, solitude.
Like haunting, isn't it?
Almost like a dirge.
It's quite dizzying, almost, because of the repetition throughout. So you're constantly in some sort of circle.
Yeah, and you're reapplying meaning, aren't you, to different things.
It's quite a vicious, horrible circle to be in. You're kept kind of whirling around in it all the time.
And if you think about the person writing it, the situation she was in, and thought process, and also her environment. She's in a hospital bed. She's isolated. She can't interact with the outside world. So it's her environment has shrunk down into a very repetitive, monotonous, painful cycle, which is reflected in the form, arguably. And any thoughts about what she's actually on? This is a lot more cryptic than the previous poem. You don't have the clear links there. I mean, you could see a metaphor running through that one. You could understand what he's saying, short lines. This one, long lines, quite unusual things that she says, like these days of horse-drawn betrayal, necromancy, etc.
Well, the idea of horse-drawn betrayal conjures up that image of an old-fashioned hearse, almost. So it's a bit anachronistic as a term, but I don't think that matters in a sense.
Now, I'd be interested generally because reading this, because I was struggling with some of the lines to think of what she could be meaning, particularly that one. In my interpretation was possibly she was talking about either these days of horse-drawn betrayal. The first interpretation I would have, based on other lines, is this idea of a loss of control. Because if you think about some of these other lines, racked on a stretch of the ivy tube, string me up. So that's as if she's some kind of puppet. Then the next line is like a cello without a player. Or in other words, the puppet doesn't have a puppeteer. So possibly horse-drawn betrayal could be the horses betraying the carriage and running off without anyone in control. So that'd be one interpretation. The other one, I thought, which you mentioned, is that it sounds archaic, anachronistic, so perhaps, and this is to take more of an interpretive leap, she's talking about the lack of medical advancement in terms of treating AIDS. So maybe she's saying, oh, it's almost as if we're back in the 19th century or something, we can't find a cure to this disease, why can't we, etc.
And what about the four horses of the apocalypse?
Yeah, possible as well. So again, the links of death or pale horse of death, etc.
Yeah.
Which is one of the nice things about when lines are particularly cryptic, you can put lots of interpretations on them. They may not be right, but then there's no wrong in interpreting poetry.
Okay, so who is then the child?
That's another interesting question. I thought, possibly, I don't know what other people think, I thought it might be some kind of maternal aspect coming in.
Yeah.
Because as a person suffering from AIDS, having a child is obviously a very difficult prospect. First of all, just physically it'd be far more difficult, and secondly, you may well pass on the virus to them, and they would most likely not have their mother for very long.
But then the fact that she goes on to say, overbuilt to compensate for no child, builds in another dimension, which I'm not sure what it is.
Or it could also be
that the child is the kind of, you know, the kind of opposite of death.
Mm.
Like we have a child which is, you know, actually growing and some kind of nurturing, and then yeah, so it might be that kind of empty image of death, where she has nurtured a child or something, like in the attempt to kind of grow and not to die.
Mm.
The opposite of this puppet thing, but something which is physical and moving and emotional thing.
Yeah, so, I mean, she does mention child in quite a few other poems, so
mm.
you wonder if it's either just a favourite symbol of hers, or if she does have this concern about not having children, because she was married, so
mm.
presumably wanted to start a family at some point. Depending on how much time we've got, I could skip ahead to the next ones to make sure we fit that one in, or we could talk about this one for a bit longer.
I'm curious to wonder what you think of the line "Impromptu Night, Tar Ridge."
That was another one I thought was fairly cryptic. My attempt to interpret that one was, I was thinking of Tar Ridge as something to get stuck in, trapped, again, so isolated, can't move. And Impromptu Night possibly is the darkness of her illness, so she can't see this coming enclosure and entrapment, or possibly a link to...
Sounds like a one-night stand.
Or it could be. Yeah, it could be that she's thinking of the haemophiliac boyfriend, but I'm not certain what the circumstances of the relationship
mm.
were.
But, like, even if it, yeah, even if they were in a relationship, like, just the fact that, you know, they had sex that one night, and then, like, it was, you know, spontaneous and impromptu, or whatever you like to call it, but then they get stuck in that
mm.
rut, that tar ridge, maybe.
I hadn't thought that, so that's an interesting...
Yeah.
Write that one down, you know.
Like
pop
that,
it in
please.
The thesis.
Back of the mind. He doesn't have to sit up.
Reference to. That does raise the point of how much biography can you apply to poems, which is always a problem. Is it important that what she's saying is actually biographical, or can she be doing this as a dramatic monologue? And how
I just
it affects.
I just wanted to ask that. You know, if he had not told us.
Hmm.
That they were either infected or not, or one of them is actually not writing about himself. So would it make a difference to me in terms of emotion to read it?
Mm, it does. I mean, I think it makes it more... I mean, I say that because we've got limited time, so it's easy just to give you biographical details so
mm.
you can start interpreting. But certainly from my previous thesis I was talking about, where it was all about sincerity and authenticity, that was a major topic. And there's a poet that is still in this thesis, but he writes about cancer, Peter Redding, who does that constantly. He plays all sorts of games with persona. You never know if he's telling the truth, if he's making things up. I mean, he mixes up real references with fake ones, so it makes for a very interesting discussion of the topic of, is it genuine? What does it mean to be genuine? Does it matter, etc.?
I think it is important in this case to note, because otherwise we probably wouldn't have a bloody clue what she was
mm.
going on about,
yeah.
to be honest. So.
Whereas with the previous poem, you might be able to work out from that it was some kind of problem he's talking
mm.
about, maybe
some kind
disease.
Of illness.
Mm.
Yeah,
whereas this one, because it's so cryptic, it's a lot harder to, and she's got ones that are far harder to interpret
yeah.
than this one later on. But there's which
even
makes
the
it
title "Voices Gym Body." I mean,
mm. and it's possible because this is actually dedicated to another poet, Marilyn Hacker, who, as far as I'm aware, is a lesbian formalist poet, but I don't know as much about her. So it could be there is some kind of link to Hacker's work, which might explain...
Hacker.
Hacker. H-A-C-K-E-R. Marilyn Hacker. So there's a few books closed in the library, so I just took one out. So there may be a link there. It's difficult to know.
I mean, I guess that's what you have to do, is, like, trace every possible connection that you can have and try and, like, sum up some kind of
mm.
coherent meaning.
Mm. Mm.
Well, in my case, I'm applying it to a specific argument, so I'm looking to draw things from it. But as just a reader, yeah, I mean, that's
yeah.
part of the interesting process of reading poetry, is thinking, what do they mean? What does this mean to me? What could it mean to other people? What might her intentions have been, etc. I mean, I think, I don't know which poet, Paul Muldoon possibly said that after a certain amount of time, the poem isn't yours anymore,
mm.
because people have built up their own interpretations, their own versions of the poem.
Mm.
So it changes. Okay, just to make sure we fit this one in. The next poem, this is the one I was mentioning to Claudia that's changes things. So this one is not in the same strict traditionalist form as the other two. It's in a long chunk of text that there may be symmetrical elements, but I don't really see them obviously. This one is by Paul Manette, who had AIDS, his partner died of AIDS, and his all sorts of friends died from AIDS. And this particular poem was part of a collection he wrote for his partner, and it contains the poems he wrote in the 6 months after Roger Horwitz's death in 1986. So again, you can see that's located within one of the high points of the epidemic. So it was just starting to become more mainstream, because in 1985, Rock Hudson was diagnosed with AIDS, or people in the media alerted people to the fact that he was getting thinner, he appeared to be exhibiting symptoms. So that led to a huge flurry of media activity.
Mm.
So that's when people really started noticing AIDS. But the writing here would still be in a period when there wasn't much spoken about AIDS. People didn't even understand how AIDS happened. The link between a virus wasn't known until much later. That was around 84 with Robert Gallo and the Pasteur Institute. So he's very angry, and you can see that in this poem. So, would you like to read this one out, Matt? Because we could do with a good reader for this one. It's a bit more difficult.
Okay, the very same. That's the one you mean, aren't you?
Yes.
The wrongest of the wrong things said that day as I stepped from the chapel, an idiot cousin, once removed, jiggled my shoulder, time to turn the page, in tone like it's all been so appalling. We must hasten now to the land of brunch there to recover our BMWs, our zest for winning in half-acre closets, Scion book late, weeks later, still fuming with retorts. But this is my page, it cannot be turned. And start hearing similar from other bimbos. Gotta turn the page, Paul. Is this shit from the Bible the signs of Dr. Kubler-Ross? Has done a show on it, maybe a ring of windows or walks of life, neatly combining real estate, aerobics and young blue-collar bowling dates. Spare me the pop coping skills, this page is all that's left of time. There was no page before I caught you. The book was nothing but cover, painfully thin and hopelessly derivative. There's something French in all this, perhaps. La vie could continue? Well, no, it doesn't. Not if you freeze in its tracks. Think of the turnless page like Audubon's Elephant Folio, where the eagle is life signs, or a gilded burgundy leaf of ours painted with one hairbrush for the whole last half of the 1400s. And no bigger than a 3x5, dear friend. I didn't become your blood brother. Likely mine ticks just like yours, but the beat's slower, the giggle of death crackles in every room, yet. You cannot seem to tell who's who, as you used to say in your cranked-up bed, playful, astonished. But we're the same person when that did happen, with death signals jammed. I and my pages have eluded the dart of wild Russians in bookhouses, write their poems on soap. We burnt matches and get them by heart, then wash in muddy water. Think what they would do with a whole page, no room left on ours, edge to edge with our growing interchangeability. What you would do, I think, is make a paper glider go to the brink of a high green place, let it cavort the updraft lulling itself by lightness to the valley floor below, while I am more likely to paper the walls with mine, scorning why and where are you in our common blood? How shall we compromise? Will a kite do you think, riding its string in the upper air? And don't forget there's an eagle on it, and the monk's guilt borders my blood cries. I'm too high up now to read now. Oh, what a page, Rogue. How can they not see I am only still here to be with you? My best, my only page, scribbled on Cirrus, the high air soaring in its every word.
Thanks, Matt. That was a tough one to read.
That's not an easy one to read, absolutely.
Yeah. And that's part of the point, I think, is that you can see here, this is much less accessible than the previous poems because it's the punctuation isn't there, it's in a long, rambling stream. It's really hard to get your head around it, even to read it and make sense of how the sentences work. As you could hear there, Matt's trying to get into sentences.
Yeah.
It's difficult, he doesn't
get
any guidelines.
It's not even stream of consciousness, like, it's beyond that. Like, it's just mind spill. Like, it's not...
The new technical term there, mind spill.
Exactly.
Virginia Woolf would die for it.
I could see a poetry journal called Mind Spill. Happening. And so, any initial reactions to that?
It's just like a collision of images, really. I like that very much.
Mm.
It's a very good poem. It's not accessible, you say.
It's
like
very evocative, isn't it?
Yeah,
you're just like, oh my god.
Just to call it the confusion, really.
Yeah.
You don't really know what he's talking about, really, for a lot of it. You get the idea something's not quite right, but that's about it. He never actually sort of says anything very much, really. But
the book, he's coming back to this book. Like, what is this book? Why is it so important? And what has it done to him to kind of, you know, force out this reaction?
Well, do you have any thoughts on what he means? Because he mentions page and book repeatedly throughout the poem.
Well,
Book of Life, is it?
Yeah, it could be. I was gonna say the body of the body is text, or body is book, or book is text, book is life, whatever, you know. So
it's obviously a rich metaphor, so there's a lot of allusions, but
like it's kind of like the script of his life, and and the way I took things I took from it, especially at places like, but this is my page, it cannot be turned. There and there was no page before I caught you. Things like that makes me feel like the other people are trying to control his life and control at the rate at which like they're reading his life. Again, going out on a limb here, but like presuming the people in his life like know that he's ill and that this is going to happen to him, and they're trying to control things like the idiot cousin, and then the other bimbos like all telling him to say you've got to move on, or you've got to do this, skip a chapter, look ahead, like look back, like what they're trying to do. So that's what I took from it.
I mean, there are two important things that should be emphasised on this, which is as I step from the chapel, so I presume that would mean you're stepping from a funeral, and the final line there, Rog, and Rog, one would think refers to Roger Horwitz, who was his partner that died. So I would take this to be writing about the funeral of Rog and his reactions to people talking about him, saying, oh, get on with life, don't worry about it, life goes on. And he says life goes on there in French, la vie continue. But he's saying, you know, shut up, life doesn't go on, you know, I've just lost some person I love, I might die myself, this is awful. And hence shouting about it, telling them that all this attempt to placate him with, for example, Dr. Kubler-Ross, and as you may know, the five stages of grief is the thing that she came up with, and also a pain spectrum, that's something that's her as well. So sort of trying to help her, help him to, oh, you can get over it, don't worry about it, and he's refusing. He doesn't want to be helped. He wants to grieve for his partner, and he wants people to know about it.
I really like that, actually, because I thought, you know, and when you told her that he's, you know, the background of the whole thing, actually kind of like that kind of form, because it is unstructured, and you're just confronted with the death of somebody and you don't know how, where to turn, and then people tell you, oh, read this book and that book and read a bit of religion and the Hour book and all these kind of other stuff, and you just don't want to hear it and you can't deal with it. And I really actually like that, this kind of one sentence in a way.
I mean, there is no full stops or anything in this. So it's
And that kind of brings me to this question of the form thing. When I was thinking, you know, that kind of way of doing it, I think is quite appropriate to deal with. I mean, if one thinks about if one is first encounters these things like death or something, it comes from a funeral in which you are not structured, and kind of to construct something like the first poem we had, would need something to step back and then put it into form and kind of somehow detach yourself from it. So where this one I felt like is kind of more immediate.
That leads in nicely to the quotes that I've got from Minette. If you go to the handout thing, second page. I'll just read this out to you. This is him writing in 1993. It's actually to the introduction to his selected poems, rather than this specific volume, which is Love Alone, which was earlier from 88. What he says is, I can only imagine what the silver tongue response will be to the body of new poems, which is the collection he's referring to that's in. Too political by a mile, unbearably strident, nothing reflected on, no form. Well, at least I've got all that right. Raw being just how AIDS has left me. Flayed of layers of skin I didn't know I had. Flayed to the bone. I was screaming as much as composing when I sat to write. Pain was pain, not wisdom. And the idea of waxing metaphorical and philosophical about such horrors seemed at best presumptuous, at worst insulting. So if I've succeeded in convincing the mainstream run of poets, with their Guggenheims and their tenure tax, with a sure-footed march to selected, collected, complete, that I mean to stay an outsider, lobbing my poems like pipe bombs, so be it. So you can see he very much agrees with what you just said. That he feels that poems this is ridiculous, you can't write about this in a sensible, formal, accessible way, you have to scream about it. He frequently in other productions talks about it as war work and makes comparisons to firing an Uzi in the air. He views himself as the front line of a war. And that raises the question, is this the way you should be writing about AIDS? Raw, rambling, unstructured, angry? Or should you be being more accessible, more refined, like Tom Gunn? He's equally in pain, he's equally grieving, he's lost lots of friends, so he's got, I mean, he wasn't dying himself, but he had the same situation that Manette was in many ways. Just watching your friends die and you don't know why, you can't do anything to help them, which is horrific, it's difficult to imagine. But his approach is completely different. He wants to step back, think about it, structure it, and use the tools of poetry to enhance his message. Manette abandons those completely. He wants to focus on the subject matter, he wants to focus on shocking the reader. My perspective would be that that's all well and good, but if you want to shock the reader and they can't actually read your poem, that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You can shock the reader with form. Peter Redding's a good example. He does things like limericks, very specifically about the unpleasant side effects of cancer and chemotherapy treatments, so about vomiting, about feces, about things shoved up, sort of anal passages and your groin, etc. Which is just as shocking, but it's easier to comprehend because you can actually understand the form he's writing in.
I think it depends on the motive of the poet.
Mm.
I think if you want to educate people and inform them, then that probably isn't the best way. But like some poets, you know, selfish, and I don't say that in a bad way. Some people write poetry because they have to, and that's because of the way they express it. Might be, I mean, I don't know if anyone has done, but like if people have written a coherent, collection almost, like, of the kind of retrospective, like, way they reacted, like, how they reacted first, how they reacted afterwards. Yes, because some people live with HIV for years, so
absolutely.
They could write collections over time. And of course, it's going to be different, like, whatever stage they're at, so, and who they're writing about.
You could look at Tori Dent for that, because she wrote three collections before she died. I think the dates was 93, 99 and 2005. And I would imagine those show some progression, but not having read all. I've only read the one collection from 99, which is where that poem is from, HIV, Mon Amour. So it may well be that she changed her opinions, or it might just be that she wanted to do not exactly more of the same, but exploring previous topics in depth rather than different perspectives on the same issue. Tom Gunn has two collections which talk about AIDS. First one is one that this is from, The Man with Night Sweats. That's from 92. Then in 2000, he wrote a collection called Boss Cupid, which isn't purely about AIDS.
I heard of that, actually.
Yeah, that was the one last one he wrote before he died. That one has various other poems in it. There's a fairly controversial one about Jeffrey Dahmer, the cannibal.
Oh, yeah.
But there's also poems about AIDS. So, yeah, those would be ones to check out if you're looking interested in seeing how people have developed their viewpoints on it. Anyone else got responses to that last one?
I think I like it for the same reason Claudia likes it.
Mm.
It's full of frenzy. It's kind of being there in the moment. It's almost as if his partner's died that instant and that's what's going through his mind, and there are so many things that it's incomprehensible on paper, but it isn't necessarily comprehensible in his mind either, but that's what's kind of fallen onto the paper as he's put his pen to it.
Mm.
And I like it for that.
And I didn't like this poem at first, but while preparing for this seminar, I was sort of trying to read it more thoroughly to get some more insight into what he's talking about. And you can see themes developing, you can see where the references are, I mean, particularly the page in the book that continues and develops.
Mm.
So it's a poem I think you can get something out of if you give it time and read it several times over.
I was going to say, like, just reading it in different ways, because because you did such a great job of trying to tackle reading it. But, you know, you can see that you could just break it up in a slightly different way and maybe get a bit more meaning, or, you know, condense two lines together and try and draw out what's going on at each particular moment. It'd be great if you just called it like AIDS or something, and then you'd be like, I have the context, I understand.
Yeah.
And then you're like, yeah, and then all this is to do with AIDS, you know, and just to kind of a bit of direction, because I know what you mean, that it's in terms of shocking people, that this can be very dangerous, because like you'll end up, everyone just goes away thinking, oh, well, you know, sounded really good, but
yeah, I have no idea what they're talking about, kind of thing. Absolutely. It's just coming up to 4 o'clock now, so. If we've got time, we can move on to the last one, or we could skip that and go to the next
session.
Okay,
let's do that.
Okay, final one is direct contrast to that one. It's short, it's to the point. There is a form at work again, but not as obvious as some of the others. It's by J.D. McClatchy. I don't know as much about him, except that...
Oh, sorry. I'm seeing the... Wow, sorry.
It's an interesting form that he uses.
Oh,
he's another gay poet, but a very academic gay poet. So this is exactly the kind of person that Minette would be talking about when he says Guggenheim, tenure tracks, etc. Not only does he have a PhD from Yale, he also teaches at Yale as an adjunct professor and is editor of the Yale Review. So in terms of academia, he's fairly up there. Yeah, very Yale, and so top university. I don't know exactly when he wrote the poem, but this one I took from a collection of AIDS poems, which is in the further reading. It's called Poets for Life, and that was published in 1989. Minette's poem collection, that the one we just read is from, that was published in 1988. So this is a year later, so it may well be around the same time. So he's talking about the same kind of feelings. As a gay poet, I would assume he must also have had many friends that died from AIDS, given the epidemic at that stage was particularly affecting the gay community. But his approach is completely different. So if someone would like to read this one out?
Oh, I do. Okay. Through the blinds, it must have been the street lamp I saw, that silvered the woodwork. Step by step, its shadow was measuring out tonight. The climb itself has been a cloud that thickens with the effort. I look up if I could. Three lines erased in the address book. The thumb pages of those last weeks through which the hayflit pen still gapes. Unwritten, and what I'm with goes without saying, has the explanation even there been brief as a flame and its ash. I speak to the air that takes these things finally as its own. Tell me who that is beyond the stairwell's next turning now.
Excellent.
Got a little bit difficult.
It's so clever.
Mm.
It's very clever, but
clever.
You don't really know how to pronounce it. Do you end at the end of the thing, or do you have to kind of carry it on?
It carries on,
isn't it?
Mm,
yeah.
It depends on the different
ways.
Normally you take the line break as a sign of at least a pause, but alternately you can just follow on to the different schools of thought.
Mm.
I mean, I don't read poems out much, because I don't really like reading out loud. Which a lot of poets would disagree with. There's a lot of critical theory about how you have to read poems out loud. It's very
right.
important to have that oral thing. I prefer having them on the page, personally.
Mm.
But that's because I like to analyse things.
The text is so smart.
Mm.
Because you're half German.
Possibly, yes. The love of order. So I think you realise what was interesting about this poem immediately.
Yeah, well, if you look at the last word of each line,
mm.
they're anagrams.
Absolutely,
the previous,
yeah.
Which is brilliant.
So
it's so clever.
Notice what she's talking about?
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's... It shows you the flexibility of rhyme. It doesn't have to be an obvious cat-mat kind of thing. You can also have this far more interesting sort of sort and words. I mean, it's not a rhyme, but it is, because it's the same word refigured.
It's a reflection, like...
Absolutely. So it's a very clever way of doing form, and innovative. And I'm not certain if other people have done this. It may well be there's a long tradition of this, and I don't know about it. But from just reading this... as we saw from reactions, you immediately think, oh, wow, that's clever.
Mm.
Which you wouldn't think from the other poem. You'd think, wow, that's powerful, it's angry. This is a very different tone, almost. And anyone have any thoughts on what he's talking about? What the meaning might be here?
I was actually distracted by the fact that they were anagrams.
Mm.
And you're like, oh yeah, you know, all the different letters moving around. And
yeah.
you know, you kind of skip ahead to look at all the other ends.
Mm.
So I wasn't actually listening to what was going on at all in the poem. Because I was too busy looking at what was going on the page.
So it could be this is a poem to read rather than
to frame.
Well, the basic content to me speaks for him just walking upstairs, probably at the end of the day, or the first time you walk upstairs after somebody's died, and you expect to see him around the corner at the top. So it's really fucking tragic.
Mm. Did it feel clear to you, though, or did you think that there was a certain amount of obscure, opaque kind of referencing in there?
Well, I think if you read it again the second time, I think Fran's right. I think what you read the first time, you are distracted by what he's trying to say, and then you actually break it down. It's very simple, you know. they're
quite cliched as well, a little bit, you know, with the whole like, oh, the clouds are drawing in, and you know, we're walking around the corner and it's dark, and something bad's going to happen to me.
But the three lines are raised in the address book is just
gorgeous.
It's cliche, but in a non-cliche kind of moment.
Yeah, no, it's the images. I mean, not the way he's described it. I mean, that's fine. But I think because they're all together, all the images that you get in your head is kind of like a really naff movie where something terrible is going to happen, and the candle goes out, and you're like, oh no.
See, I disagree. Like, I know it's meant to be cliche, but just because it's written so simply and like so unapologetically, in that sense, like I love that. That kind of couple of lines, three lines raised in dress, but the thumb pages of those last weeks to which the half lit end still gapes and written. It's like, you don't, that's not cliched. That's really, I don't think that's cliched at all. Like, that's just a little detail which he noticed. That, like, I don't know how to put it.
Or maybe it's like a cliche but zoomed in. So, like, you've got the overall image, but then the detail of it that he's saying is. That thing that no one notices is within a cliche.
Yeah.
And were you going to say something?
and just the idea of erasure as well. Just the fact that's in there is really smart. So
the movie is sort of unease about the whole thing. Really, the movie is called uneasy, and there's this sort of sense of unease over the whole poem, which I suppose would be good.
I also thought I have actually some difficulties with it, but I mean, I was thinking, is it about this kind of also the night advancing and getting dark and kind of, and it's kind of dangerous or it's unknown, and so it's coming this kind of, I felt this kind of fear, or this kind of fear he has of the night. And then in the end, when he asks this question, tell me who there be on the stair was, and it's turning now, it's this kind of, I don't know where it's going, it's going to be night, it's going to be dark, and then nobody knows what the next.
I think there's certainly, from my reading, there's definitely a theme of uncertainty and the vague. Because you can see that progressing throughout. So it starts off with through the blinds. So he's half looking. You can't quite look through a blind properly because you have to kind of peer through. The street lamps silver the woodwork. So there's a slight light on the woodwork. It's not full, it's not clear. Then there's a shadow. That's followed by a cloud. Then you get the lines erased. Half lit, brief as a flame, and then a focus on the air and uncertainty about who's at the next stairwell. So there seems to be a theme running through there about things being vague and indistinct and uncertain.
But slightly vague and slightly indistinct.
That they,
it's very measured.
I mean, as I mentioned, it thickens with the effort, so there's a certain amount of things becoming clear as he goes up the stairs. So the stairs, either it's just a reflection of walking up the stairs, you look at your address book, you might have had friends that have died, or something has changed, it means you've erased them. Or if you're going to be poetic about it, it could be a metaphor for a journey. So this is perhaps his way of dealing with his grief over the dead friends. And he's climbing up the stairs. But I think it responds to a number of interpretations. So the idea of who is that beyond the stairwell's next turning. You could take that as a very positive thing. He's been quite hopeful and optimistic. Like, okay, I've gone to the top of the stairs, I've looked at the address book, let's move on. What new challenges, what new people await me? So he's progressed from his grief. Alternately, it could be that this talking about indistinct and uncertainty, he's still trapped in the past and in his grief, and he's looking for ghosts and looking for the people to come back. Who is that beyond the next stairwell? Well, perhaps he's looking forward, oh, is it that person? I know he's dead, but I wanted to be him coming to see me. Completely different interpretations from the same poem. So although he's only written five stanzas here, it's a very short poem, I think it's quite rich in illusion and metaphor and the possible readings, which is what makes it a good poem, in my opinion. Any other thoughts?
Could it be what's at the top of the stairs is that someone is coming to take him to those people that were in his address book, and is he going to be the another erased line in someone else's address book as well?
Yeah. Absolutely, yeah. So it's lots of potential readings. It's about 10 past now, so we could have a general chat about what you would think about the poems as a whole and AIDS, or we could move on to something else, depends on.
And I think it's quite interesting, like, how indirect these are, you know, I mean, like, when I knew that you were studying kind of aids, you know, in poetry and form, that kind of thing. I imagined that there would be, you know, a couple of kind of maybe American poets who, you know, I don't know, like I just thought it'd be really obvious, like, you know, My Life with AIDS or,
yeah,
you know, some indication. Or, I mean, have you found any that have explicitly, you know, apart from maybe that guy, that Boucheron guy,
right,
who,
yeah,
was a bit more, you know, I mean, and these are really interesting and kind of getting the nuance out, but like, is there a canon, is there a kind of AIDS poet society type thing?
I don't know if I'd call it a canon, but there's certainly various poets that have written the kind of poems you're talking about. I mean, Boucheron would be one. There is a certain vagueness there too, because in his introduction he talks about how the series of epitaphs that he writes, so that's as in someone speaking of their life, so a dramatic monologue, are based on real people, but not entirely so. So there's elements of both fiction and fact in there. But a lot of them have things like, Epitaph for a Carrier is someone talking about having AIDS, what they did, how it made them feel. Or there's Epitaph for a proprietor, I can't remember the exact term, but that's the owner of a bathhouse, which we mentioned earlier, talking about how, yeah, my bathhouse is fine, nobody's dying here, we're just having fun. No, I died, but I died from a weak heart, not from AIDS. So it gives you a spectrum of at least what Boucheron thought was the gay community at the time. And that probably fits more with the picture that you're speaking about there. Although, personally, I don't actually think those poems are always good, but they are interesting from that analytical point of view.
But, you know, and I just imagined that there would be this kind of nuanced and, you know, it wouldn't be that obvious, but you still know, you still have that direction at the start. But no, that's cool.
That's the thing, I mean, should poetry be clear and autobiographical?
No!
Or should it be nuanced?
It should be
there's room for plenty of different types, of course.
Human intellect.
But there's a range, because you don't want to be too obtuse and pretentious in your poetry, because then no one's going to read you, apart from people that want to
go. But it depends what you want with your poetry, because I thought that maybe this stuff could be used as a form of activism, and like getting people involved, like trying to educate others about what AIDS is doing to individuals and trying to prevent it kind of spreading. Whereas a lot of this, you know, and I know that we've only looked at a couple of poems and, you know, not indicative of what everyone else has written. But, you know, it does seem very kind of, you know, selfish, you know, which is, they have the right to be, but, you know, like, I thought there would be this motivation to kind of spread the word about it rather than, you know, wrap up within yourself.
I think that's a very important point. That's certainly something I discuss in the thesis, is the idea of can poems contribute to activism in cancer as well? I mean, in the cancer chapter, there's an example of some poems written specifically as part of an ad campaign about getting women to check their breasts for cancer. And they're doing it through poems. It was the Think Pink campaign, Claire Kalman. And some of these AIDS poets, you could say Manette says that explicitly, that he sees this as a way of talking about AIDS and forcing people to speak about it and look at it. But then you think, is that going to make me look at it? Given sort of when Matt was trying to read that, it's really hard to understand and to get hold of it. So is that really effective advertising for people who aren't ready to read it?
And it's a bit alienating as well, because you're like, oh my God, you've got AIDS and you're like this, and God, I don't want to help anyone else, you know?
Yeah, I mean, there's another quote that refers to that. It's by Judith Lawrence Pasteur. She edited a collection of criticism that was called Confronting AIDS Through Literature, The Responsibilities of Representation. And that's in the library, if anyone wants to check it. And what she says in that introduction is imagining what people might say. Who wants to read about such a horrible disease? Doesn't the media assault us enough every day with worldwide tragedy without your asking us to share the suffering of PWAs, which stands for people with AIDS? It's supposed to be a non-political way.
Catchy.
Yeah. So they don't like saying victims or sufferers, so they come up with PWA. And their loved ones. Many people question whether reading imaginative literature about AIDS will really create more compassion and understanding. Perhaps more crucially, they question whether reading such literature will lead to active attempts to combat the disease. And she then goes on, obviously in her collection, to say, well, let's have a look, and has a number of essays by various people talking about how they use literature to talk about AIDS, to talk about disease. So if you're interested in that topic, that's definitely one collection you should read. And it's an interesting topic generally, particularly with a disease like AIDS, which people don't want to deal with, they don't want to talk about it. There's other social issues involved, there's homophobia involved in there. There's the lack of understanding about the science behind it. So how do people contract AIDS? You still have people who think you can get AIDS from sneezing. So there's still a lot of misinformation and misunderstanding.
I was, do you know, are there kind of poetry workshops for AIDS or something? Because there is this, you know, other diseases like chronic pain disease or something, they're now using this photography. I mean, I was talking to an artist who's doing actually photography with people in wards. I mean, to express their kind of pain or kind of, you know, feelings through art.
Mm. But the idea of poetry therapy certainly does happen, and there are various organisations. If you look particularly at cancer, thousands of programmes about getting cancer patients, families that have someone with cancer, even doctors, to write poems.
Mm.
And there are lots of collections. So there's a guy called Dr. Frank Mayskins. I don't know if his poetry is any good, I just read this in the newspaper, but he's a surgeon that wrote a collection of poetry about his patients. And there's one of the poets I'm looking at, Julia Darling, who died, you may know, and who died from cancer herself. She has a blog, which is still there after her death, and she was involved with a specific part of the University of either Northumbria or Newcastle that was based around writing poetry in hospitals for patients to use that to express their emotions. And there's also various collections, one of which, I'm not sure I can remember the exact name, it's edited by Celia Hunt. But that's also in the library. It's about how we can use poetry to discuss medical issues.
Mm.
But yeah, if you're interested in that, you can email me and I've got various books I can send through to you.
But so you're saying that there's no kind of programmes for AIDS? I mean, obviously it's not up to you to kind of know.
I imagine there probably
all the programmes
is.
In the world.
Yeah.
There's all kinds of various poets and embedded in hospitals and doing workshops, and so there could well be one for AIDS. It might not necessarily be published in what's people.
No, because I just wondered if there was like a taboo around, because obviously cancer is,
yeah,
is quite a neutral subject in its own way.
Well, I think it may not be the right word to use. It's more acceptable in a sense because you don't have those social issues of homophobia, etc.
Mm.
But on the other hand, it's also more frightening in a way because everybody is at risk of cancer all the time because you don't need to catch it from somebody, you don't need it from a virus. It's in your body waiting. So it's liable that a lot of people are going to get cancer. In this room, probably. A few of us will have cancer at some point. So in that sense, it's very frightening. So that would be something I would have thought would make it taboo and that you wouldn't want to talk about it. But there seem to be many groups doing poetry about cancer. So if you just put that in Google, you'll find thousands. Probably as phrase as well. I mean, there's certainly been creative projects. Like there's the Names Project, Quilts, etc. So there's involving craft and creativity, so there's presumably something in poetry too.